What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I speak with Bruce Bueno de Mesquita. Bruce is a political scientist, a professor at New York University, and a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's written many books. Chief among them has been The Dictator's Handbook, co-authored with Alistair Smith. He specializes in international relations, foreign policy, and nation building. He is one of the originators of selectorate theory and was also the director of New York University's Alexander Hamilton Center for Political Economy from 2006 to 2016. Here we discuss The Dictator's Handbook. This is where we kind of circle our discussion around, and we discuss dictatorships, and we discuss fascism and regimes, some of the mechanisms that lie behind it from a political science standpoint. It was a real pleasure speaking with him. It was the sort of conversation I've been wanting to have for a long time. And now I give you Bruce Bueno de Mesquita. Okay, I'm here with Bruce Bueno de Mesquita. Bruce, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. I've been interested in talking about the topic of totalitarian regimes and dictatorships for a long time. Just haven't been quite able to find the person to have the conversation with. So I want to discuss that with you. I want to discuss certainly your book, The Dictator's Handbook. Give us something to sort of circle our discussion around. Before we do, Bruce, please tell listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
I'm Bruce Bueno de Mesquita. I have the longest name in political science, with the exception of my son, whose name is exactly the same length. I'm a professor of politics at New York University. I'm a senior fellow emeritus from the Hoover Institution at Stanford. I use game theory to study politics. Who I am really is a person who thinks that we should be using the scientific method to understand politics and not opinion and cherry-picked evidence and so forth. My most recent work has been in the development of mathematical models of governance, jointly with Alistair Smith, who's a colleague of mine here at NYU, and earlier as well with James Morrow and Randolph Severson. Jim Morrow is a professor at Michigan, and Randy Severson is a retired professor from UC Davis.
Excellent. Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate it. I respect the Hoover Institution a great deal. I'm eternally grateful to them for curating all of William F. Buckley's firing line material and making it available. So I'd love to know, how is it that you became a fellow with them?
Well, that was a long, long time ago, and I left Hoover quite a long time ago. I was a professor at the University of Rochester, where mathematical political science originated, and one of my colleagues had moved to Hoover and thought that work I was doing at that time on international conflict and particularly game theory models for forecasting political outcomes was something that the Hoover Institution would be interested in. They offered me a job, and eventually I turned it down the first few times, but eventually they persuaded me and I moved there. And then starting in 2000, so that was in 1986, in 2001, I was for the next 9 years a senior fellow full-time at the Hoover Institution and a professor full-time at New York University, which was a little exhausting, since they're a continent apart. On 2009, I decided to leave Hoover and come really full-time to New York University, and there I am.
And here you are. Excellent. Thank you. So yes, so winding the clock back then, Bruce, what was it that inspired you to write The Dictator's Handbook?
Well, earlier, with Alistair Smith, Jim Morrow, and Randy Severson, we wrote a very technical book called The Logic of Political Survival. Might as well show it off.
There, excellent, excellent.
It's an MIT Press book. So that book develops the first serious treatment out, and the first treatment of the selectorate theory that we developed. And that book's probably got 100 or so pages of calculus in it. So it's not exactly the most readable of tomes. So after 8 years after that book was published, Alistair and I slogged through. We were colleagues in the same place. It was easy to work together. We decided that the ideas behind the book were important enough that people who were not going to be reading a lot of calculus should know about it. So we wrote The Dictator's Handbook, no math, no statistics, but everything that we say in The Dictator's Handbook, and there's a second edition now with new chapter and so forth, is completely accurate in terms of what we were able to prove game theoretically, but is explained in plain English and with lots of examples. Turns out it's a lot easier to write the calculus than to say it really carefully in ordinary language.
Isn't that interesting?
You know, ordinary language has a lot of vagaries and math does not.
Oh, sure. Yeah. One won't often find an idiom in calculus. Well, one. You know, Bruce, one of the words that I find to be very often both over and misused, it's been completely bled out of all meaning, is the word fascist. It's become so misused to the point where I feel like a fascist at this point is simply someone that you call a fascist, right? I'd like to ask you, dwelling on your game theory and political science expertise, in your view, what is fascism exactly and how would you define a fascist?
Well, that's a very interesting question. So I would technically define a term, by the way, which I would not choose to use, just as I wouldn't use Democrat or autocrat and so forth, because the selectorate theory tells us that we can talk much more precisely. But anyway, fascist, I suppose, fascism is a form of government in which the policymaking is controlled by a coalition that consists of labor and the elite. It's an unusual combination. There's a wonderful book that would set out these ideas quite carefully, very old book called The Stages of Political Development by AFK Organsky, published about, I don't remember exactly, around 1961, 62, 63, somewhere in there, long time ago. But as I say, I'd prefer not to use such terms because of the content behind your question, which is, what do these things mean? I prefer to think that every government and indeed every organization can be thought of on two dimensions. How large is the pool of people who have a say in choosing leaders? And how large a group of people does a leader need to ensure that the leader stays in power? So in the United States, all adult citizens have the right to vote. So they have at least a nominal say in choosing leaders. We have, in the case of the presidency, a very complex system because of the electoral college, which means that it's not one person, one vote exactly. A vote in Wyoming buys you a lot bigger proportion of an electoral vote than a vote in California buys you. Having said that, in the United States, the winning coalition is about can be as small as about 20% of the population. If you place your votes really precisely, you only need about 20% to get a majority of the electoral college. In Britain, in a two-party race, you need about 25% of the vote. In North Korea, you need around 11 to maybe 200 people, a bunch of generals, a bunch of senior civil servants, some family members. In China, maybe as few as 7 to 11 people. In the Catholic Church in the 12th century, topic on which I've just written a book, in the 12th century, you could choose a pope with about 7 or 8 votes. So some places need a lot of support from a big pool. Some places, like monarchies, need a small amount of support, a small winning coalition drawn from a small pool, the royal family. And in some places, like what we typically refer to as rigged election autocracies, everybody has a nominal say and very few people's votes really count. And those are the winning coalition. So it can be a very small group from a very big pool. You can explain pretty much, well, a very large amount about politics from just knowing the size of those two things, the winning coalition and the Selectorate.
Wow, that's fascinating. Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate that. I know you went through a decent amount of it already, but maybe I'll just ask you clearly, and if there's anything you want to add to it, just let me know. Could you explain then the concept of Selectorate theory to the extent that you haven't already, and what its relevant is to understanding dictatorial regimes?
Sure. So let me say a little bit more. There are two critical things to solve in thinking about how governments work. One is, so in the Selectorate theory, leaders want to stay in power. That's their main objective. And conditional on staying in power, they want to have as much discretionary control over revenue as they possibly can. With that discretionary control, they can steal lots of money, sock it away in a Swiss or secret bank account. Swiss accounts are no longer so secret. So say a secret bank account, or they could spend it on civic-minded projects. And they might have good ideas about that, like Lee Kuan Yew did in Singapore, Deng Xiaoping did in China. Or they might have awful ideas about how to do that, like Kwame Nkrumah had in Ghana, or like Mao Zedong had in China. With the money that they are spending, not for themselves, they're buying two things: policies, public goods to benefit everybody, and private goods, basically corruption opportunities for the people in their winning coalition. That's why those people are interested in being in the winning coalition, because everybody benefits from public goods. So it turns out it's pretty easy to show that when the winning coalition gets bigger, a leader who wants to survive would not be well advised to have a lot of corruption. It's inefficient. Mm-hmm. But if you only have to pay a few people, then allowing corruption is much more efficient than producing good public policy, because you only have to pay off a small number of people. You can give them a lot. So what you're thinking of as dictatorships are highly corrupt governments because they depend on very few people to keep them in power. And what we might think of as democracies depend on a very large number of people, so they can't afford to be corrupt. In this theory, there are no good people and bad people. There are leaders trying to stay in power. Then there are always rivals. There are always other people trying to take your job. So you have to pay the coalition enough that they think they're better off sticking with you than they would be if they defected to somebody else. Somebody else has the problem that they can't guarantee they'll keep you in their winning coalition, because they might find out you're not that loyal a guy. So they're going to sort out, they'll take whoever will support them to come to power. Once they're in power, they're going to sort it out. And so you have a chance of being dropped from the coalition. Once you're in the winning coalition, your odds of staying in are much higher than when you first come in and the leader is learning how reliable you are. So it turns out that that tells us the conditions under which governments are likely to be stable or unstable, vulnerable to revolution or to coup d'etat or invulnerable to them. So if I can just a little bit more.
Absolutely.
If we think of the size of the winning coalition as running from small over here to bigger over here, and we think of how well paid individual members of the coalition are, very little down here to a lot up here, the derived welfare of coalition members looks like this swoosh, this Nike swoosh. When the coalition is very small, they get lots of goodies. They're made rich. As the coalition gets bigger, two things happen. First, you dilute private goods, so their benefits drop per person. But as the coalition gets bigger, the proportion of coalition to Selectorate is growing. So the person in power has to pay the coalition more because the expected value from the challenger is rising. Your odds of staying in that person's coalition are getting better. So eventually this turns up. It goes up slowly. It doesn't go up as quickly as it drops, but it goes up. That produces an interesting dividing line. So down here, when the coalition's really tiny, I'm getting a lot of goodies, very few public goods. As the coalition gets bigger, eventually, I'm getting as much out here on a bigger coalition as I was getting when it was tiny. In part, that's because I'm getting a lot more public goods value, and in part because the proportion of revenue that is being spent on the coalition, instead of being taken by the leader, has to grow. And when that grows, the percentage that is private goods shrinks, but the absolute value micro, as I like to say to my students. You might get 1/6 of a 12-inch pizza, or we might divide it up among more people. You get 1/8 of an 18-inch pizza. It's a smaller proportion of the pizza, but it's a bigger amount of pizza. So, you know, you could be getting richer. So once you pass below this point here, I can make people better off by purging people or expanding the coalition. So I get coups and revolutions. Once I pass this point, nobody in the coalition and nobody in society can reasonably expect to benefit from shrinking the coalition. So coups and revolutions are very, essentially, you're immune from them once you pass this point. In fact, historically, no country passed this dividing line, at least since 1789 when we have data. No country past that point has had a successful coup or revolution.
That's incredible, Bruce. Thanks for taking a minute on that. I appreciate it. I understand that we don't really want to use words like Democrat, Republican, left or right, and so forth. And I'm as anxious to remain apolitical as you are, because undoubtedly a number of our listeners will be, you know, both of a left and right persuasion. So you might have to forgive the question. Just curiosity is getting the better of me. I am curious, and we do nonetheless have, you know, words like right wing dictatorship, left wing dictatorship, and so forth. I'm curious, Bruce, of all the dictatorships that you've studied, do you find that there is a heavy lean towards a left or right wing persuasion?
Not really. Interestingly, I mean, I've seen very recent history in the period of the Soviet Union, dictatorships were left-leaning. But if we went into the 19th century, monarchies, a form of dictatorship, were right-leaning. I'm going to say so. Outrageous. You know, Karl Marx spoke of religion as the opiate of the people.
Yes.
I prefer to say that ideology is the opiate of the people. Leaders want to come to and stay in power. If you have strongly held beliefs, it's really hard to stay in power if it happens that your beliefs are different from the beliefs of the people who keep you in power. But there's a big difference between having beliefs and saying you have beliefs. So the only sure way to tell whether a leader really believes what he or she is saying is, do they adopt policies that they know, or at least believe, will get them out of power? If they do that, then you can believe that they're sincere. So when Winston Churchill, in his El Alamein speech, said, "I did not become the king's first minister to preside over the dissolution of the British Empire," that is, hey, when the war is over, you guys reelect me, I'm not getting rid of the empire, I'm keeping it. He knew that was a very unpopular view. His eventual rival, Kamadatli, that's not the right. Anyway, his eventual rival said, oh, you guys have suffered so much during this war. I want to give you national health care and lots of benefits. And they voted Churchill out before the war was over. We can believe he really meant it, because he could easily anticipate that it was going to be a bad thing. Strom Thurmond was an intensely committed segregationist until the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. He was a senator from South Carolina. He remained in the Senate till he was 100 years old. He started to be more supportive of some civil rights legislation. Why? Well, before the Voting Rights Act, he didn't have the risk that there was a black voting constituency that would vote him out, because blacks were prevented from voting. Once they were permitted, allowed to vote, he had to change his tune. Who was the real Strom Thurmond? Almost certainly the segregationist. Does that really matter? What matters is the incentives that are induced by changes in the institutional structure. He needed a bigger winning coalition. He changed his behavior.
That's interesting. Do you view, in the same way you view Strom Thurmond, would you also apply that then to George Wallace?
Yeah, of course. Now, in George Wallace's case, he took a position that he thought could be a winning position. When he ran for president, he believed he could be a sufficient spoiler that while he might not get elected to the presidency, he would get like-minded people elected, and he would be in a good bargaining position. get like-minded people is consistent with he really believed what he was doing. Being in a strong bargaining position is consistent with, well, maybe I believed it, maybe I didn't believe it, but you guys think I believe it. That's enough to give me leverage. So my guess is he genuinely believed what he had to say, but, you know, he didn't take actions that ensured he would lose power. So we can't say with confidence what he believed in his heart of hearts. And again, I come back, what, do we really care what somebody believes in their heart of hearts? What he did is what he should be judged on. In my view, he did despicable things and he should be viewed that way.
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, one thing I'd love to talk with you about, sort of the philosophical side of the road to power. You know, the road to power is, I think, a fairly easy one to map out psychologically. You know, there will always be people that thirst for power and desire control over others and so forth. People want power and they take it. I'd love to talk a little bit actually about why it is that people seem to be so quick to obey. Why is it that people will be, without really being coerced all that much, will happily subservate themselves to a dictatorship? I'm thinking specifically of the Stasi, for instance, right? What we saw, what was it? I think it was half of East Germany was spying on the others once the paperwork was burst out. So what are your thoughts on, let's call it, the road to subservience?
So we first should be very careful about assuming that people endorse the oppression that they may be subjected, that they may believe they would be subjected to. So if we take the East German case, I'll use a little game theory speak. In equilibrium, and I'll give a concrete example from Genghis Khan, in equilibrium, I shouldn't have to bash in a huge number of heads to convince people I am prepared to bash in heads. I only have to bash in a few. Once I've bashed in a few, then people who are living under me have a reasonable expectation that if they do things that I don't like, if they are perceived to be disloyal, they will be cut off from benefits and they will be made to suffer. On the other hand, if they do what I desire, whether out of conviction or out of fear, they'll get some benefits. I'll leave them alone at minimum, and maybe I'll give them some opportunities to be corrupt or what have you. And so things will come out better for them. You know, if you could do a survey in North Korea and you ask people what they think of Kim Jong-un, I'm pretty confident 100% would tell you that he's practically a god. And I'm pretty confident that if you could have asked people in Poland before Lech Walesa's separatist movement began, whether they liked their government, they would have said yes, fewer than in North Korea, because it was not as oppressive as North Korea. They would have said yes, whether they did or didn't, because it was very dangerous to say otherwise. So I don't know that we can certainly say people obey. I don't know that we can say that they endorse. Why do they obey? So there are lots of reasons to obey. One I've just pointed out, because they understand it's really costly. You don't have to beat them up for them to know they're going to get beaten up. You know, it's pretty clear that if you went out and demonstrated in Saudi Arabia against the government, it will go very badly for you. So hardly anybody does that. People are demonstrating in Iran. A lot of people are being killed. It's very courageous of them. But millions aren't demonstrating because they know it's dangerous. You know, if the U.S. government does something we don't like, we demonstrate. You know, we know a few people might get hurt, but not many. And we certainly know that it's not going to be the sort of violence that you would see if you did that in North Korea. The other thing is that governments that are oppressive are smart enough usually to understand that they have to do enough so that the people don't rebel. So again, I invoke the word equilibrium. If a leader can anticipate that this or that behavior will provoke people to rise up against the government, and rising up against the government is very costly to put down, then the government, the leadership will probably have adjusted their behavior in anticipation of the rising up so people don't rise up. And they can adjust their behavior in two ways. They can essentially buy people off by providing more public goods, Or they can hire people to go out and bash enough heads so people are convinced they shouldn't come out and oppose the government. So we can't really know much about why people obey in autocratic settings. In democratic settings, more generally, people obey because the government is doing what they want, because you can't stay in power otherwise. So governments tend to stop doing what the people want in democracies when a leader is close up against term limits, because then they can't get reelected. They don't care what the people want.
Interesting. Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate that. I'd love to dwell, perhaps just for a moment or so, on the life cycle of a dictatorship, and I'll kind of explain what I mean. I recently read, I'm sure you'll be familiar with Hannah Arendt and the origins of totalitarianism. For our listeners, in the book, she borrows from Immanuel Kant the ideal of radical evil. And this is evil that is evil. It's basically the surplus value of evil, evil for its own sake, evil that promulgates past the point where you've made your point to your people. They know who's in charge. They know who the boss is, but you can't stop. There have to be, you know, mass graves just for children, for instance. And in the book, the ideal basically is that dictatorships never can sustain because they fall into this downward cycle of just pure radical evil. And I'm curious just to get your thoughts on that, if you happen to have any.
So I have a quite different take from Hannah Arendt, not inherently arguing that she's wrong, was wrong, but arguing she had the wrong causal mechanisms in mind. So in a small coalition, large selector environment, petty dictatorship, potentially totalitarian regime, in order to stay in power, you have to be prepared to bash in heads. If you think that your behavior is going to lead people to rise up because they think they don't have anything to lose, they're so bad off with you, there's no downside, then it turns out, so I'm now going to make an empirical statement, it happens, Alistair Smith and I at the moment are working on leader life cycles. It turns out, if you engage in extra legal killing, you increase your probability of surviving in power by 280%.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's rather a depressing fact, that you're almost three times more likely to survive if you engage in extra legal killing than if you don't. So what we are thinking of as surplus evil, a strategy for political survival. That's very depressing, but it tells us that there are two things that can be going on and we don't know how to tell them apart. You're just evil, or the sort of person who gets selected to run such a government is, and maybe that's the same as saying you're evil, although the surplus goes away, the sort of person who is willing to put themselves up to become a potential leader of such a government is somebody who must be willing to engage in extremely horrible actions because their rivals are. And if they're not willing to, they won't survive to succeed. So it may be that it's all selection effects. That's why I say I don't quite disagree with her. I just have a different causal mechanism in mind. It is easier to lead an awful sort of government, very small coalition, big selector of government, if you are willing to do things that are evil than if you are not. So it's an equilibrium. Huh. I really am a game theorist. You know, I do believe in what is the stable state of affairs.
Right. That's very interesting. Thank you, Bruce. So then I suppose keying off the status quo point, Bruce, I'd love to know, how, in your view, do economic conditions affect a dictator's ability to hold on to power?
Ah, wonderful question. So I'm going to give you several. I'm sorry to be long-winded, but a lot of work on this question.
I'm interviewing you, absolutely.
First of all, poor economic performance is a killer for democratic leaders and is, at the margin, a benefit for dictators. A low productivity society leads to higher survival prospects than a high productivity society. Now I'm going to say that again in a little bit more technical way, going back to this swoosh curve. So I'm now going to tell you a little bit more about this swoosh curve than I've told you. So, right, we've got this shape. Exactly how steep this part of the shape is or how flat depends on how costly it is to produce public goods. So it turns out, if you think of public goods, the cost of public goods as being a consequence of economic productivity, and if you think of economic productivity in terms of the amount of human capital in a society, by which I mean how educated the society is, how capable people are to do work either at a higher level or more efficiently, more quickly, so it produces more wealth. Societies that are really good at producing public goods have this incline is steeper. So the cut point where you don't have coups and revolutions comes sooner, but the leader's welfare is decreasing as coalitions get bigger. If the society is bad at producing public goods, if it's inefficient, I'll give you some concrete examples within democracy in a moment, this gets flatter. If you're sufficiently bad at it, they never intersect. If they never intersect, then the best place to be is a really small coalition. That's better for leaders. And so the leaders made the coalition more loyal to the leader. They're both maximizing their welfare. So economic troubles are not a particularly bad thing for dictators. They're very bad things for Democrats. Even within democracy, if you think about how this flattens out, ask yourself, among the world's more democratic countries, which ones have more separatist movements, more efforts to bring down the government or to have, you know, insurrection, civil war, and so forth. India has lots of domestic movements. It is a low productivity society, relatively speaking. It's a big coalition, but the educational attainment is relatively low. Productivity is low. It's a relatively poor society as a result. That's been working pretty well so far for the prime minister, but there's lots of separatist and insurrectionist movements. If you go back 20 years or 30 years or more than 30 years, I guess, that there was a strong separatist movement in Canada, in Quebec. At the time, Quebec was near the bottom of educational attainment among the Canadian provinces. More, a less steep slope, more vulnerable. If you look at Spain over the, you know, maybe 15 or so, 10 years ago, although Catalonia produces the largest share of the gross domestic product of Spain, its productivity has been sliding for quite a while. It has a separatist movement. So in democracy, that's a very bad thing. In an autocracy, that makes it easier for the leader to stay in power. So leaders in autocracies and dictatorships are generally not keen. There are exceptions, and we can explain those exceptions. They're generally not keen on education beyond elementary education that gives people just enough skills so they can follow instructions and do menial tasks. So as we point out in the Dictator's Handbook, if you look at the 200 top-ranked universities in the world, there are two in China, there's one in Singapore, these are non-democratic countries, and all the rest are in democracies. One city in Switzerland, as many top-ranked universities as all of China. Switzerland's not even the population of Shanghai.
Wow. That's extraordinary. Thank you, Bruce. That's very interesting. I'd love to talk about how pressures from external pressures, let's say, from the international community in the form of sanctions, you know, potential intervention, etc. I'd love to know how these pressures can impact a dictator's ability to maintain power.
Okay, let's start with sanctions. Interventions are quite different. So I'm going to tell you how game theorists think about sanctions. I'm going to do a little mind experiment. Imagine you are a dictator. You're kept in power by a small group of generals and so forth. You're surrounded by these critical people with guns. They have guns. They keep you in power because you pay them well, and you generate the money to pay them well by doing things I don't like. So I threaten you. I say to you, look, if you don't change your behavior and do the things that I think you should do, I'm going to stop doing business with you. I'm going to sanction your economy. I'm going to make you lose money. You think to yourself, well, if I don't give in to Bruce, I'm going to lose some money. If I do give in to Bruce, what are those generals going to think of me? Are they going to think I'm a trustworthy guy who can take care of them? Probably not. They're probably going to try to kill me. Let's see. Which is worse? What Bruce is going to do or what they are going to do? Oh, Bruce is going to do is not as bad as what they're going to do. I'm going to ignore the sanctions threat and keep doing what I'm doing. Now, of course, it's going to cost me something. But then the generals know that if they shoot me and replace me, if there are the sanctions are threatened, you know, the next guy doesn't have any more money available. But if they shoot me before I agree to the sanctions, maybe Bruce won't impose them because they'll think maybe this new guy will be better. So you sort through all of this complicated set of calculations. Most of the time, you conclude it's worse to give in to me than it is to not give in to me. That it's better to have the sanctions than to tick off the people who keep you in power. If you came to the opposite conclusion, I would never impose the sanctions because you would change your behavior before the sanctions were imposed. So once sanctions are imposed, you should think, I should think they're not going to work. And in fact, approximately 96% of the time when sanctions are imposed, the evidence is that they fail to work. So sanctions are not they're a weak strategy. They are a signal that you're not willing to do something tough. Okay, intervention. So intervention by a big power against some little guy, in fact, works from the big guy's point of view. You get to overthrow the big guy and put in somebody more to your liking who will follow the policies you want. What does that turn out to mean? I wrote a paper on intervention many years ago, and two of my colleagues, one in the economics department, one in my own department, didn't believe. I wrote this paper with a colleague named George Downs, who sadly died a number of years ago, and they didn't believe our results. So they did it in a different way, got the same results. What were the results? The results were that when democratic governments intervene in internal disputes in non-democratic governments, they don't turn them into democracies and make sure that they are autocracies with some decorative hints of, like, they'll create elections, but make sure that they're rigged. Why do they do that? Well, what is the job of a democratic leader within the selectorate way of thinking? It's to get reelected. How do you get reelected? You do the things that benefit your constituents, not the things that benefit people in another country necessarily, unless coincidentally what they want is the same as what your constituents want. But if they want something different, then you have to make sure that instead they adopt the policies your constituents want. So when you intervene and you impose a new government, you impose somebody who will do what your constituents want. And what will they do that for? Well, the easiest way to get them to do that is if they don't have a big winning coalition. Because if they have a big winning coalition, they have to do what, if it's good public policy, it's to do what their constituents want. But if they only have a small winning coalition, they can make their little constituency very happy with money. You, the Democrat who has intervened, pour money into them. They pay off their cronies to agree to what you, the Democratic intervener, wanted. You, the Democratic intervener, improve your chances of getting reelected because you're doing what your constituents want. And they've improved their chances of staying in power because they have more money with which to pay their cronies. It's a win-win. We call that money foreign aid, by the way.
Money foreign aid. Interesting. The idea of, I think you said decorative democracy. The term I was thinking of as you were talking was ornamental democracy.
Perfect.
Sure. The idea of that is a new concept to me. And I'm just sort of curious if, in your experience, when you see, to coin a phrase, you know, imposed democracy, so to speak, is it typically, so to speak, standard practice for the ornamental democracy to be propped up?
So there aren't a lot of examples of imposed democracy that lasted long enough that, you know, there weren't just a flash in the pan. So we tried to impose a democracy in Iraq after we overthrew Saddam Hussein. That unraveled pretty quickly. The constitution that we helped Iraq write was indeed ornamental. It's a very nice word for it. It was an ornamental democracy. The actual winning coalition was a few hundred people, so it was pretty sure not to work well. We did impose democracy at the end of World War II on Germany and Japan. We did it slowly. Germany and neither Germany nor Japan had an election that was not supervised by the Allied military forces for 10 years after the war ended in the mid-1950s. And we helped write both of their constitutions. In the case of Japan, we helped to write a constitution that disproportionately gave votes to the rural agricultural areas rather than the cities, because the rural agricultural areas were more conservative. There were more socialists and communists in the cities. So we wrote a constitution that would guarantee that the government would be essentially pro-American. That worked quite well. And in fact, with the exception of a few years, the LDP has governed Japan since 1955 with two brief interludes. It's a one-party state, not exactly a competitive democracy. And I haven't looked at the latest data, but if you go to Freedom House and you look at freedom of the press for, as I say, I haven't looked in the last year or two, but generally among the members of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the richest countries in the world, Japan is either the only or one of the only countries listed as having an almost free, but not fully free press. If you look at Germany, and by the way, after the end of the Cold War, when we no longer had a strong need to control what went on, the Japanese made changes. And now the cities, of course, there aren't communists to speak of in Japan and so forth anymore, but the cities got much better balance of representation. They reformed the electoral system. So today, the cities are not so underrepresented as they were. In the case of Germany, we wrote what seemed to me to be very surprising electoral rules. Germany has an extreme proportional representation system. Israel's system is closely modeled after the German system. It seemed odd to me that Germany did not get a British Westminster-style parliamentary system that's first past the post. Why did that seem odd? Adolf Hitler and the National Socialist Party, National Socialist Workers Party, was elected under an extreme proportional representation system. That's how they came to power. Didn't seem like a good idea. But anyway, fortunately, the German people seemed pretty quickly to come around to the idea that they liked a democratic government, they liked a market economy, and so they tended to be following policies that the Allied powers as well liked. Of course, at one point, there was a deviation. Willy Brandt was elected as chancellor, and he instituted what was called the Ostpolitik policy. That is, West Germany really should be following the logic of economics and be doing more business with its communist neighbors, East Germany, Poland, so forth. And so he adopted such a policy. A scandal was quickly uncovered, and he was removed from power.
One of the things I was thinking of as you were talking, Bruce, you know, one of my favorite things to, I suppose, dote upon is the idea of freedom of speech, freedom of expression. And then, of course, the axiomatic discussions about freedom of the press. One of the things that everyone either knows or think they know about a dictatorship is how freedom of the press will be quashed to serve the dictatorship. And I'm just curious what your line is on how a dictator's need to stay in power grades into how they then control the press of that country.
Very important question. So there are, in the selectorate perspective, three essential freedoms. I mean, there are many essential freedoms, three freedoms that are essential from the perspective of citizens' prospects of government doing what the citizens want. Free speech, free press, and one you didn't mention, freedom of assembly.
Mm-hmm.
of the three, the most important is freedom of assembly. Or let me rephrase that. The one that is most dangerous for dictators is freedom of assembly. The probability that you will be out of power next year if you allow people to freely organize and demonstrate to bring you down is 82%.
Huh. Wow.
Really not a good idea to allow freedom of assembly. Okay, so in the Dictator's Handbook and in other works, we make a big deal about what we call these coordination goods. That is, the reason these three freedoms are so important is that in order for people to bring a government down or, in anticipation of being brought down, get their government to become more accountable, they have to be able to coordinate with each other, to organize to oppose the government. That means they have to be able to talk to each other, to tell each other, you know, I don't like what the government's doing. What do you think? Since people far apart can't easily talk to each other in societies where you don't have good connections or that they're listened to, you need a free press to tell you, by the way, you know, those people in Pretoria, they don't like what's being done. And then you need to be able to assemble to make it costly for the government to hold you down. Freedoms are free. It costs nothing to have a free press. It's very expensive to censor the press. It costs nothing to have free speech. It costs a little to have freedom of assembly. You have to protect the people who are assembling. It costs much more not to have freedom of assembly because you have to pay a lot of people a lot to be willing to go out and bash in the heads of people who assemble. Okay, so if you're a dictator, these freedoms are the pathway to taking you out of power. So therefore, you have to not allow them to happen before it makes it possible for people to organize. I think back after many years ago, I think it might have been after the Nargis cyclone, about 15 monks in Myanmar demonstrated against the government. 15. Massive military turnout, crushing them. Because if they didn't crush the 15, the next day, there might have been 1,500. Too dangerous. Alistair Smith and I like to obnoxiously joke that if Muammar Gaddafi had called us up, he'd be in power today. He made terrible mistakes from a dictator's point of view. He wanted to curry favor with the United States and the West Europeans. To do so, he stopped torturing people. That's a mistake. And he went from having the second least free state in that part of the world to having the second freest, least free press, to the second freest press in that part of the world. Very big mistake. He started to educate his population. Here he was running a petrostate. He didn't need a skilled population. He had tons of money sitting in the ground. He could bring in a foreign oil company, do the operation of pulling it out of the ground, and yet he was educating his population so that they could figure out how to coordinate with each other and bring him down. And they did. Very big mistake. So freedoms are to be avoided if you want to be a successful dictator.
Wow. I think I just found the tagline for this episode. Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate that. I just have a couple questions left, Bruce, and then we'll close our time together. I really appreciate you taking the time for me here. How was it then that the Netflix series came about as a result of the book?
I really have no idea. They called me up one day and said, they're doing a book on tyrants. Would I be willing to be on camera and answer a bunch of questions? So I said yes, and I sat with them for many, many hours, and they wrote a few moments of those many, many hours. And they did the same with Alistair and, of course, with other people, too. So, yeah, I have no idea how it came about. I enjoyed it. I had issues with it in terms of the way I understand tyrants and the way I don't look a lot at the psychology of tyrants because there's all these selection effects and they spend a lot of time on their psychology, which just does. I'm sure it's interesting. It just isn't a powerful explanation for me. So, but yeah. It was nice. I enjoyed it. It was fun. And I have no idea where the idea came from.
Yeah, I understand that. It is interesting discussing the psychology of dictatorships, but it's sort of, there's no right answer as such.
Well, get it. We go back to, you know, to what you asked me early on in this interview. It's very hard to tell the difference between a true psychopathic leader and somebody who acts like a psychopath, because that helps keep them in power.
Indeed. So what are you working on currently then, Bruce? I think you mentioned earlier a book about the life cycles of leadership.
So it's about more than that. That's a piece of it. Alistair and I are writing a book called, tentatively called, Political Instability. We're extending the selectorate theory. We're adding dynamics to the theory that includes life cycle as a dynamic effect, but other things as well, to explain when leaders choose to change the mix of public and private goods that they provide, their policies, when they choose to change their institutions to become more democratic or more autocratic, when they choose to engage in suppressive behavior, torturing people, killing people, and when instead they loosen the reins and allow more freedom. So I'm working on that, and I just finished a book called The Invention of Power, Popes, Kings, and the Birth of the West, which is for a broad audience, like The Dictator's Handbook. The book that Alistair and I are writing is like The Logical Political Survival. It's got more math in it than The Logical Political Survival had. It's mathematically very dense. Maybe after a while, we will figure out how to say everything in English, and we'll write A Dictator's Handbook of Political Instability. The Invention of Power is an explanation of what people refer to as Western exceptionalism. And the claim is that the critical turning event, that's a game theoretic treatment, but all in English, no math, that the turning event in European history was not the Protestant Reformation. It was 400 years earlier. It was the Concordat of Worms in 1122. If you have a minute, I'll just tell you about the Concordat of Worms.
Sure.
So the Concordat of Worms settled a dispute between the Holy Roman Emperor and other kings and the Pope, who gets to pick bishops. And the deal was the church will nominate bishops. The relevant secular ruler over the diocese will get to say yes or no. If says yes, the guy's installed as a bishop. But if the secular ruler said no, then the income from the diocese went to the secular ruler until the church came up with a nominee that the secular ruler agreed to. This has three different possible consequences depending upon the wealth of the diocese. In a poor diocese, it didn't pay to tick off the Pope because it wasn't enough money to be had. So the Pope would nominate somebody who was, or the church would nominate somebody expected to be loyal to the church. King would say yes. If the diocese was moderately wealthy, then if the church nominated somebody loyal to them, would do the policies they wanted, the king might conclude, or the secular local ruler might conclude, that the money was worth having for a while, and so reject the nominee. So in anticipation, the church would nominate somebody expected to be loyal to the secular ruler, in exchange for which then the ruler gets more policy control and the church gets more money. When the agreement was passed in the diocese, for example, that were on trade routes, there was a 50% spurt in the selection of what I call secular rulers, that secular bishops. That is, people whose job before they became bishop was working for the king instead of for the church. If the diocese was really wealthy or became really wealthy, then the secular ruler didn't care about bishops. They wanted the policy control and the money. And so you get the Avignon papacy in France, and then you get the Protestant Reformation caused by this. Well, along the way, you can also show that this caused differences in economic growth across Europe, and which explains the differences today in per capita income. And it led the parts that signed and were getting secularized, led them to create parliaments. And the parts that didn't sign on or were not getting secularized didn't get parliaments. So it created tremendous transformations in Europe. That's the other thing I think about these days.
No, that's wonderful. Thank you, Bruce. I appreciate it. Well, excellent. Bruce Brenner de Mesquita, this was a real pleasure, sir. Thank you so much for taking the time for me. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
I had a good time. I appreciate your taking the time.
Absolutely. I will let you go, sir. And thank you so much for everything. Once this goes out, I will make sure I get a link out to you as well.
Super.
All right. Great. Take care, Bruce.
Nice to meet you.
Bye-bye.
Ciao.
Thanks for listening to this episode.
If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.